Last week we talked quite a little bit about Jeremiah himself and about the place that Jeremiah occupied in the stream of prophets of God. We pointed out to you that the role of the prophet seemed always fraught with struggle and distress, difficulty, and God had to use them as object lessons many times to the world. They stand in a way throughout the stream of history as a testimony to the fact that God's concern is not with material prosperity, but with spiritual factors, you see. So to press the issue that the people that are trusting in the Lord or the people that are blessed of God are going to have all their problems solved would be missing the deepest implication of Scripture. You go down through the Old and New Testaments, including the apostles, Peter, Paul, others, their lives were a constant witness to the fact that in this world, suffering was the rule rather than the exception. That is not to say that the Lord would never allow prosperity materially for his own reasons. There are many reasons why the Lord might allow someone some material blessing, one of the chief of which is that they might help to support the work of the Lord. The Lord gives the gift of giving. If he gives the gift of giving, he will also give the wherewithal to give. So for those reasons, he may do that. And so I want to clarify the point that I am not saying to you, don't ever ask the Lord for anything material. So we are not saying that you cannot prosper. But I am saying to you that, generally speaking, prosperity is the exception rather than the rule in the fellowship of believers. And that material distress or circumstantial distress may be more the sign of God's presence than the sign of his absence. He can trust you with distress. He may trust you to be sturdy and stay with him no matter how things are going with you in your life. So that, thus now, Jeremiah becomes another one of the examples of those whom God allowed to struggle all the days of his life from beginning to end. And he was often in wretchedness and misery. And yet, out of his mouth came great words of help and comfort to us, as well as great words of judgment and warning to God's people. It is not primarily a book of blessing. Part of Isaiah's book is a book of blessing. Perhaps 40 or 30 chapters of Isaiah, a little less perhaps, deal with God's blessings. First part of the book have to do with God's warnings. But now the warning has already gone unheeded, and the die is cast, the situation is fixed, and God's people are going to go into captivity. We pointed out to you that God would not even let Josiah bring about a revival among his people. In fact, he said to Isaiah to tell them that these things are so that they that I'm going to blind their eyes, and I'm going to harden their hearts, lest I hear from them and they repent and I turn and not do what I'm intending to do. Almost saying that my heart is so open to these people that I don't want to get conned by them into helping them when I have got to be hard on them. I don't want to be easy on them. I've got to be hard on them for the sake of redemption in the world. And I don't want to hear them because I'm paraphrasing here, and I'm not saying this is what God said. I'm only paraphrasing and saying perhaps this is what he was thinking. Because he did definitely say, I'm going to harden their hearts so I won't turn and not do this that I intend to do. So it may be that he felt that for his own ear to listen to words of repentance was almost a guarantee that he would repent of his or would turn from his purpose of judgment and punishment. And he didn't want to do that. Sometimes I've had to talk pretty firmly to people who have been involved in helping some that were a constant drain on them. And I've said to them, the Lord has not given you the ministry, the grace, the help, the power to help that person. But the heart is tender and soft, and sometimes that person can come back with an appeal, and the heart is open, and one listens to the appeal. Many a mother, for example, has spent a lifetime being drained and destroyed by a young person, young man or young woman, who has never had anything but heartache for them, and they are not capable of handling that person. But because the mother heart is open, the person comes back and says, oh, please forgive me, I won't do any more. And they go back and do it. And it happens year after year after year. And both persons get torn down. The recalcitrant or incorrigible young person and the tender-hearted mother both go down from that kind of appeal. So sometimes we have to be very firm and say, no, this is not possible for you to do. This is, God has not given you the capacity to handle the situation. As an aside, I want to say to you, be very sensitive to what the Lord does give you the capacity to do. Paul says that in Romans, I'm just going on with this, I didn't intend to say this, but in Romans 12, Paul sounds a warning and he says, now don't think of yourself beyond what God has given you to think. Beyond what you ought to think, but let everyone think in a level-headed way according as God has dealt to everyone the measure of faith. There are some people God will give you the capacity to help, and some people He won't. And it may almost be a matter of pride, individual pride, that says, I'm not going to give up on this person. Well, now, maybe the Lord is not blessing your relationship to that person. Maybe they need someone else. And as long as you are there in the picture, they're not turning to the one that they need. But you're not helping them either. If you find that year after year, your relationship to someone is not helping them, is not blessing them, is not changing them, then you must think very seriously about whether possibly the Lord has not given you the grace to help that person and that perhaps you should let someone else do it. Now, Jesus followed that all along. It was a very firm principle with Him. There were some He said, I can't help. And they turned away and He let them go. He let them go because it could be a constant drain and drag. A lot of these people, all they want is circumstantial help. They don't care about the Spirit. They just want you to help make their life nicer. We're not in the business of making people's life nicer. It's our job to minister in the Spirit. And if you're not ministering in the Spirit, leave them alone. The Spirit is not blessing your work with them. And remember now the time of the rich young ruler that came to Jesus. And he said to Jesus, what else do I need to be saved? And the Lord said, well, here are the commandments. And he said, oh, this is nothing. I've already done all of that. And he says, fine, just go sell all you have and minister and give it to the poor. And come and follow me. And the fellow turned away. He went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Now it says that Jesus, beholding him, loved him. Jesus' heart went out to that young man. And he would have been, in our mind, quite a prize. We would have said to ourselves, as I hear hundreds of times, oh, what a great person that would make for the Lord if we could only get them saved. And I say that's probably wrong. Probably some simple soul working at a workbench would be greater in the Lord's kingdom than that person because it'd be so hard to get them off their high horse and get them out where the Lord can help them. But we have such a strange, warped set of values, you see. And we have such a constantly humanistic and humanitarian attitude toward people. And we think that we're being very, very gracious to people. We're going to help them and we certainly don't want anybody to think we're not Christian by turning away from someone who needs help. But there comes a time when you have to turn away for their salvation, if they're ever going to be saved. Well, the time came, that rich young ruler just turned away, and Jesus did not run after him. He did not go down to him and say, oh, wait, you misunderstood me. I don't really mean all. I just meant, in principle, be sure you care for the poor. He didn't say anything like that. He let him go. He let him go. Because it is the realization on the part of a person of their deep need of Christ's help can ever furnish the basis for help. If they just think they need your help, leave them alone. You haven't got enough resources to help. There are a lot of people that it wouldn't matter how much help you gave them. They'd need more. There is no way that you could ever satisfy the needs of some people. It's because they're coming to you from the flesh. The flesh is never satisfied. Now, with Jeremiah, the only message that Jeremiah has for the people of Israel basically is that they're going to be in judgment. But here and there in the book, there are shafts of God's glory. Here and there throughout the book. It's a dark book. But there are shafts of blessing in it. And I want to open up one of these this morning, chapter 17. The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron and with the point of a diamond. You see, that's the fixity of the thing. God had given Israel her last warning. She had failed to heed it, and now there was nothing in heaven or earth that would stop the wheels of God's judgment from turning. Whilst their children remember their altars and their groves by the green trees upon the high hills, O my mountain in the field, I will give thy substance and all thy treasures to the spoil, and thy high places for sin throughout all thy borders. And thou even thyself shalt discontinue from thine heritage that I gave thee, and I will cause thee to serve thine enemies in the land which thou knowest not. For you have kindled a fire in mine anger which shall burn forever. Now, I want to make this clear to you. As we read the judgments of the Old Testament, especially, against Israel, we may erroneously place ourselves in that position and think to ourselves, maybe I have sinned so much, or maybe I have been so much out of order that God will not hear me anymore. We may erroneously apply that. But I want to tell you what it was that turned God away from Israel. It wasn't that they did this or that aggravating thing. It wasn't that they were out of order in certain matters of holiness or of righteousness. The problem was that they had turned to worship idols. They had turned to other gods. It was the kind of devastation that adultery would make in a marriage. God had been put away in favor of idols. And in spite of the repeated warning to them, they persisted in setting God aside, who had borne them across that wilderness, had been patient with them for 40 years, had brought them into the promised land, given them a land flowing with milk and honey, had been constantly with them, put up with their grumbling and murmuring and complaining, all of these things. Now suddenly when they got in the land, first of all, they were disobedient in not really ridding the land of its inhabitants. Once again, you've got to understand God's brand of judgment. Here were a group of people, the Canaanites, that would corrupt his people. The seal was there. The die had been cast as far as these people of Canaan were concerned, because their idolatrous practices had gotten them totally turned away from God's help. I do not presume to know all that goes on in God's mind, but I can tell you this much. If anyone is inclined to weep for the Canaanites and say, oh, these poor souls, they didn't really know any better, well, God has a brand of judgment or justice that we don't even understand. Good thing God's running this world or we'd destroy it. And we're even now, it's so obvious that our humanitarian hypocrisies will destroy the population of the righteous whilst we play with the population of the wicked. We play games with a criminal. We set him up in business. We spend more money placating the criminal and making things nice for him so that he won't suffer too much than we ever did spend on the people who are just trying to be good citizens. It is a warpage of the mind. Everybody seems to go root for the underdog. Nobody thinks about the victim. They always think about the criminal. He's the one they have to rescue. But anyway, it's a human brand of injustice, I should say, a human brand of hypocritical humanitarianism that has no place in the kingdom of God. So God's order to the Israelites was that they should wipe out the Canaanite civilization. Because if they didn't, God's people would be corrupted. Well, they didn't wipe them out. They had too many bleeding hearts that were more concerned about the poor, sweet Canaanites than about the people of God. Moving on in this chapter, I just wanted you to see the position that Israel was in before God. Remember that about 950 B.C., the kingdom of Israel was divided. David reigned and Saul about the millennium in the 900s, around 1000, I just say 1000 B.C. for easy remembrance. Around 1000 B.C., David was king in Israel. After David came Solomon to the throne, and Solomon ruled in such a way that the kingdom of Israel came to its height of glory. Solomon had a son, Rehoboam, who turned away from the Lord and ruled with such a heavy, tyrannical hand that the people revolted against him and the nation split. And 10 of the tribes, the 10 northern tribes, elected or picked Jeroboam for their king, and the 2 southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, stayed together, and they had Rehoboam first and then the series of kings that followed him. Now the 10 northern tribes were usually referred to as Israel, and the 2 southern tribes referred to as Judah. Now in the 10 northern tribes, they were overcome by Sargon II, about 622 B.C. That was before Judah was taken in captivity. So these 10 northern tribes, whose capital was Samaria, were defeated by Sargon II, about 621 B.C., and dispersed throughout the Middle East, and then the further dispersion up into Europe and so forth. Those 10 tribes have never been heard from since. They are the so-called 10 lost tribes of Israel. There are some bright ones that try to identify America with them, and they try to identify Britain with them, and all of it is specious and unavailing. These 10 tribes have been merged into the populace, and they are lost as far as God's dealings are concerned, because they put themselves out from under God's dealings by their division. All right, the 2 southern tribes, Benjamin and Judah, both go by the name of Judah. And most of God's dealings then were with Judah. Now, after the split, there never again was a revival of spiritual interest in the 10 northern tribes. But in the 2 southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, there were several notable, what we would call, revivals. There were some good kings in Judah. There were not any in Israel that really followed God. But in Judah, there were some men like Hezekiah and Jehoshaphat and Josiah, whom we just recently read about, three of whom were responsible for strong revival activity among the people of God. Now, those all happened in Judah, the southern 2 tribes. So in Jeremiah's reference here to Judah, he is talking about the 2 southern tribes, but he is excluding a reference at all to the 10 northern tribes who are, for the most part, to be regarded as the 10 lost tribes of Israel. With all of this, I'm going to go on to verse 5. Thus saith the Lord, Cursed be the man that trusteth in man, and maketh flesh his arm, and whose heart departeth from the Lord. For he shall be like the heath in the desert, and shall not see when good cometh, but shall inhabit the parched places in the wilderness, in a salt land, and not inhabited. Blessed is the man that trusteth in the Lord, and whose hope the Lord is. For he shall be as a tree planted by the waters, and that spreadeth out her roots by the river, and shall not see when heat cometh, but her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful, or I should say anxious, that's a better reading here, shall not be anxious in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? And there the Hebrew, desperately wicked, the Hebrew word is very sick. The heart is sick. Now, this is the word of hope in Jeremiah. Whereas God had dealt a severe blow to the nation of Judah, to his own people, yet all through the history of the Bible, individuals still always had the opportunity of relating to God. And there was the remnant, the faithful remnant, to whom Jesus appeared in the first coming. They were looking for him. In the temple, Simeon and Anna were looking for the Messiah. John the Baptist was the one that came and prepared the way for Jesus. He was one of the faithful remnant. And Mary, who was the mother of Jesus, was one of that faithful remnant who were looking for the Messiah. Remember when the angel came to Mary, she was thrilled that she should be the mother of the Lord. And the faithful remnant were looking for the Messiah in that simple way. The Pharisees were not looking for the Messiah coming simply in the womb of a virgin. They were looking for a prince coming on a white charger to deliver them from the Roman Empire and set up the glory of Israel again, you see. So they were way off base. But that faithful remnant, they had the witness of the Spirit in their hearts about the coming of the Messiah in a more or less understandable way. And so when Jesus came, they did, with further help from the Spirit, recognize him as the Messiah and turn to him. And when the miracles were performed, many believed on him. Those miracles, remember, were not done to get atheists to believe in Jesus. The miracles were done to confirm to the faithful that Jesus was the Messiah. They were not done to convince people that they ought to come from a way of unbelief to Christ. They were done to say to the faithful, this is the sign of my coming. They didn't mean a thing to the godless. The Pharisee was so blind that even if he saw the dead raised right in front of him, it didn't make a bit of difference to him. They wanted to get that dead man that was raised from the dead, lest he turn people away from them. I'm saying to you, Jeremiah has a word here for those who still, in spite of the idolatry of their fellow countrymen, were open to following God. And he says to them, cursed is the man that trusts in the flesh. He's speaking in terms here of religious idols that neither see nor speak nor hear. That's the flesh, trusting in religious activities that had no identification with God himself at all. He says, cursed are those that go that way. And he said they're going to be swallowed up by the drought and by the wilderness. Verse 7, blessed is the man that trusteth in the Lord and whose hope the Lord is, for he shall be as a tree planted by the waters that spreadeth out her roots by the river and shall not see when heat cometh, but her leaf shall be green and shall not be anxious in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit. Now he goes on to say the heart is deceitful, and the word in Hebrew there is insidious and overreaching. That's where this matter of the commerce civilization comes in. in the middle of Indonesia, and for some reason unknown to anyone so far, the whole population was wiped out. And here were these great massive temples and buildings on a scale of the Mayans in Mexico and the Egyptians. And these buildings were wiped out by the jungle. The jungle had so encroached upon and overreached these buildings that they couldn't even be sighted from air. They didn't know that that place existed for centuries until some explorers happened upon it going through the jungles. You couldn't see it from the air. And the jungle overreached it. That's the figure where he says the heart is deceitful. The Hebrew word means to overreach, insidious. It's a shoot, a sprout of the vine here and a shoot of the vine there that begins to overreach, and pretty soon the whole civilization is wiped out. He says this is the position of the man who ignores God. Just a little bit here and a little bit there. They hold on to some values and others gradually erode away until finally the whole person is in a position of drought and of wilderness. And now he says that blessed is the man whose hope is in the Lord, and the great parallel is Psalm 1. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly. The word ungodly in Hebrew, rasha, means ill-regulated, out of order. It talks about anyone in the world who does not identify with God. No matter what he does, his life is totally out of order. He may be the most orderly person in the world, but apart from God, his life is nothing. He can be the greatest humanitarian in the world, but it turns sour. Karl Marx started out to be a humanitarian, but his whole system turned sour because it was godless. He was trying to get help to the oppressed masses and so forth, but early in his work, his humanitarian ideas turned so sour that today he represents the very epitome of inhumanity to man. His society, his approach. That's the way it goes for those outside of God, you see. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners. That is, does not make himself a part of the sinner's process. Not easy to do in this world, but very important. It's a great thing to be said for keeping yourself as much uninvolved with the processes of sinful man as possible. The things that the godless do, the things the godless create, the things that the godless work with and organize to whatever possibility. And we can't altogether, as Paul says, you'd have to go out of the world. But just watch it. Just watch your involvement with the godless. Anything they produce, I don't care how great it is, anything a godless person produces has something of the serpent in it. Just watch it. He stands not in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, the scorner. The scorner is the one who mocks the things we're talking about. The scorner is the scorner of God, the one who mocks God. Like the man who said to his young son who came to me with this problem. He was saying, the son had become a Christian, and the father was saying to him, why? He said, I've built a whole business and never had to talk to God at all. You know, and he was very wealthy. And the boy wanted to know, what can I say? It's true, my father's prospered mightily, and he's never prayed, never talked to God. And of course I said, well, God's not in the business of building businesses. If he wants his soul saved, he's going to have to come to God. If he wants to build a business, go ahead and do it. He was a scorner. And we're not to sit in the seat of the scornful. Notice the progression. Walk, stand, sit. It's that overreaching, the tentacles reaching out to gobble up the unwary. We first pass by, and then we stop and look, and then we sit down. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. That is, muse. The Hebrew word has the idea of just having a conversation with yourself. If you know Christ, if you have Christ in your heart, 100 times a day things come up that you think about. Somehow the things of God seem to constantly come into focus. I don't mean that you sit down and pray 100 times a day. You wouldn't get any work done. I don't mean that you have any great meditations about it. I just mean that if you're a child of God, constantly things keep coming up that relate to your relationship to Christ. Something, you know, here's a decision to make. Here's a need of some kind. Here's a friend that you want to help. Just one thing after another keeps coming up. Should I do this or should I do that? What does the Lord think of this? Or here's a friend that calls. And you ask yourself, I wonder how that friend is with Christ and so forth. Just continually. The follower of God, the things of God are constantly with us. Perhaps like women with your children, you see. There's always something going on with those children, no matter how old they get. There's always something. They become very much part of you, and you become part of them. In his law doth he meditate day and night, and he should be like a tree. You hear the ring of Jeremiah here. He should be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth his fruit in his season. That is, like a tree that brings forth its fruit in its season. Its leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever it does shall come to successful fruition. In other words, whatever that tree is supposed to produce, that's what it'll produce. If it's a peach tree, here come the peaches every summer. Here come the peaches. If it's a fig tree, here come the figs. You are godly trees. Your tree, you are planted in God. And everywhere through your life, God keeps emerging. One way or another, here comes something regarding God. Whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. The ungodly, the ill-regulated, are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind driveth away. For the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment. If you want to stand in the position of the ungodly, remember, the ungodly are not going to stand in judgment. Not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous, for the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. The only thing of value and import in your whole structure of life, the only lasting value, is that which belongs to God. All the ideas that are brought forth out of the world, all the creations of the world, everything that has to do with Satan's world is like chaff, going to be blown away. The only thing you do that has merit is that which you do at God's bidding or do in his name.